told anything else. I pressed him for approximate dates and bits of fact that would lend substance to the claims. He was very happy with my work. When I was finished, he admired the sheets and said, "Look how neat they are. Potter never done a job like this. They'll go straight through or I miss my bet." I wrote out a short agreement regarding the business between us and had him sign it. I gave him $25 and told him I would give him another $25 when we made our departure. The $50 balance would be paid on the successful completion of the job. I said, "That advance money will cover the expenses for the both of us. I expect you to provide the food for us and the grain for our horses."
"You'll have to bring your own bedding," said he.
"I have blankets and a good oilskin slicker. I'll be ready to go this afternoon as soon as I have got me a horse."
"No," said he. "I'll be tied up at the courthouse. There are things I must attend to. We can get off at first light tomorrow. We'll cross the ferry, for I must pay a call on an informer in the Cherokee Nation."
"I will see you later today and make final plans." I took dinner at the Monarch. The man LaBeef did not appear, and I hopefully assumed he had moved on for some distant point. After a brief nap, I went to the stock barn and looked over the ponies in the corral. There did not seem to be a great deal of difference in them, apart from color, and at length I decided on a black one with white forelegs. He was a pretty thing. Papa would not own a horse with more than one white leg. There is a foolish verse quoted by horsemen to the effect that such a mount is no good, and particularly one with four white legs. I forget just how the verse goes, but you will see later that there is nothing in it. I found Stonehill in his office. He was wrapped in a shawl and sitting very close to his stove and holding his hands up before it. No doubt he was suffering from a malarial chill. I pulled up a box and sat down beside him and warmed myself. He said, "I just received word that a young girl fell head first into a 50-foot well on the Towson Road. I thought perhaps it was you."
"No, it was not I."
"She was drowned, they say."
"I'm not surprised."
"Drowned like the fair Ophelia. Of course, with her, it was doubly tragic. She was distracted from a broken heart and would do nothing to save herself. I am amazed that people can bear up and carry on under these repeated blows. There is no end to them."
"She must have been silly. What do you hear from the Little Rock soap man?"
"Nothing. The matter is still hanging fire. Why do you ask?"
"I will take one of those ponies off your hands, the black one with the white stockings in front. I will call him Little Blackie. I want him shod this afternoon."
"What is your offer?"
"I will pay the market price. I believe you said the soap man offered $10 a head."
"That is a lot price. You will recall that I paid you $20 a head only this morning."
"That was the market price at that time."
"I see. Tell me this. Do you entertain plans of ever leaving this city?"
"I am off early tomorrow for the Choctaw Nation. Marshal Rooster Cogburn and I are going after the murderer Cheney."
"Cogburn," said he. "How did you light on that greasy vagabond?"
"They say he has grit," said I. "I wanted a man with grit."
"Yes, I suppose he has that. He is a notorious thumper. He is not a man I should care to share a bed with."
"No more would I."
"Report has it that he rode by the light of the moon with Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson. I would not trust him too much. I have heard, too, that he was particeps criminis in some road agent work before he came here and attached himself to the courthouse.
He is to be paid when the job is done, said I. I have given him a token payment for expenses, and he is to receive the balance when we have taken our man. I am paying a good fee of $100.
Yes, a splendid inducement. Well, perhaps it will all work out to your satisfaction. I shall pray that you return safely, your efforts crowned with success. It may prove to be a hard journey.
The good Christian does not flinch from difficulties.
Neither does he rashly court them. The good Christian is not willful or presumptuous.
You think I'm wrong.
I think you are wrong-headed.
We will see.
Yes, I am afraid so.
Stonehill sold me the pony for $18. The Negro smith caught him and brought him inside on a halter and filed his hoofs and nailed shoes on him. I brushed the burrs away and rubbed him down. He was frisky and spirited, but not hysterical, and he submitted to the treatment without biting or kicking us. I put a bridle on him, but I could not lift Papa's saddle easily, and I had the smith saddle him. He offered to ride the pony first. I said I thought I could handle him. I climbed gingerly aboard. Little Blackie did nothing for a minute or so, and then he took me by surprise and pitched twice, coming down hard with his forelegs stiff, giving severe jolts to my tailbone and neck. I would have been tossed to the ground had I not grabbed the saddle horn and a handful of mane. I could get a purchase on nothing else, the stirrups being far below my feet. The smith laughed, but I was little concerned with good form or appearance. I rubbed Blackie's neck and talked softly to him. He did not pitch again, but neither would he move forward.
"He don't know what to make of a rider so light as you," said the smith. "He thinks there is a horsefly on his back."
He took hold of the reins near the pony's mouth and coaxed him to walk. He led him around inside the big barn for a few minutes, then opened one of the doors and took him outside. I feared the daylight and cold wind would set Blackie off anew. But no, I had made me a pal. The smith let go of the reins, and I rode the pony down the muddy street at a walk. He was not very responsive to the reins, and he worried his head around over the bit. It took me a while to get him turned around. He had been ridden before, but not, I gathered, in a good long time. He soon fell into it. I rode him about town until he was lightly sweating. When I got back to the barn, the smith said, "He ain't so mean, is he?" I said, "No, he is a fine pony." I adjusted the stirrups up as high as they would go, and the smith unsaddled little Blackie and put him in a stall. I fed him some corn, but only a small measured amount, as I was afraid he might founder himself on the rich grain. Stonehill had been feeding the ponies largely on hay. It was growing late in the day. I hurried over to Lee's store, very proud of my horse, and full of excitement at the prospect of tomorrow's adventure. My neck was sore from being snapped, but that was a small enough bother, considering the enterprise that was afoot. I went in the back door without knocking, and found Rooster sitting at the table with the man LeBeef. I had forgotten about him.
"What are you doing here?" said I.
"Heidi," said LeBeef. "I'm having a conversation with the marshal. He did not go to Little Rock after all. It is a business conversation."
Rooster was eating candy. He said,
"Sit down, sis, and have a piece of taffy. This jaybird calls himself LeBeef. He claims he is a state ranger in Texas. He come up here to tell us how the cow eat the cabbage."
I said, "I know who he is."
"He says he's on the track of our man. He wants to throw in with us."
I know what he wants, and I have already told him we are not interested in his help. He has gone behind my back.
What is it? Said Rooster. What is the trouble?
There is no trouble except of his own making, said I. He made a proposition, and I turned it down. That is all. We don't need him.
Well, now, he might come in handy, said Rooster. It will not cost us anything. He has a big boar Sharp's carbine if we are jumped by buffaloes or elephants. He says he knows how to use it. I say let him go. We might run into some lively work.
No, we don't need him, said I. I have already told him that. I have got my horse, and everything is ready. Have you seen to all your business?
Rooster said, Everything's ready but the grub, and it's working. The chief deputy wanted to know who had done them sheets. He said he would put you on down there at good wages if you want a job. Potter's wife is fixing the eats. She's not what I call a good cook, but she's good enough, and she needs the money.
LaBeef said,
I reckon I must have the wrong man. Do you let little girls hoorah you, Cogburn?
Rooster turned his cold right eye on the Texan.
Did you say hoorah?
Hoorah, said LaBeef. That was the word.
Maybe you would like to see some real hoorahing.
There is no hoorahing in it, said I. The marshal is working for me. I am paying him.
How much are you paying him? Asked LaBeef.
That is none of your affair.
How much is she paying you, Cogburn?
She is paying enough, said Rooster.
Is she paying $500?
No.
That is what the governor of Texas has put up for Chelmsford.
You don't say so, said Rooster.
He thought it over. Then he said,
Well, it sounds good, but I have tried to collect bounties from states and railroads, too. They will lie to you quicker than a man will. You do good to get half of what they say they will pay. Sometimes you get nothing. Anyhow, it sounds queer. $500 is mighty little for a man that killed a senator.
Bibbs was a little senator, said LaBeef. They would not have put up anything, except it would look bad.
What is the terms? Said Rooster.
Payment on conviction.
Rooster thought that one over. He said,
We might have to kill him.
Not if we are careful.
Even if we don't, they might not convict him, said Rooster. And even if they do, by the time they do, there will be a half dozen claims for the money from little topwater peace officers down there. I believe I'll stick with Sis.
You have not heard the best part, said LaBeef. The Bibbs family has put up $1,500 for Chelmsford.
Have they now? Said Rooster. The same terms.
No, the terms are these. Just deliver Chelmsford up to the sheriff of McLennan County, Texas. They don't care if he's alive or dead. They pay off as soon as he is identified.
That's more to my liking, said Rooster. How do you figure on sharing the money?
LaBeef said, If we take him alive, I will split that $1,500 down the middle with you and claim the state reward for myself. If we have to kill him, I will give you a third of the Bibbs money. That is $500.
You mean to keep all the state money yourself?
I have put in almost 4 months on this job. I think it is owing to me.
Will the family pay off?
LaBeef replied, I will be frank to say that the Bibbses are not loose with their money. It holds to them like the cholera to a nigger. But I guess they will have to pay. They've made public statements and run notices in the paper. There is a son, Fatty Bibbs, who wants to run for the man's seat in Austin. He will be obliged to pay. He took the reward notices and newspaper cuttings out of his corduroy coat and spread them out on the table. Rooster looked them over for some little time. He said,
Tell me what your objection is, sis. Do you wish to cut me out of some extra money?
I said, This man wants to take Cheney back to Texas. That is not what I want. That was not our agreement.
Rooster said, We will be getting him all the same. What you want is to have him caught and punished. We still mean to do that.
I want him to know that he is being punished for killing my father.
It is nothing to me how many dogs and fat men he killed in Texas.
You can let him know that, said Rooster. You can tell him to his face. You can spit on him and make him eat sand out of the road. You can put a ball in his foot and I will hold him while you do it. But we must catch him first. We'll need some help.
You're being stiff-necked about this. You're young. It is time you learned that you cannot have your way in every little particular. Other people have got their interests, too.
When I have bought and paid for something, I will have my way. Why do you think I am paying you, if not to have my way?
LaBeef said,
She is not going anyhow. I don't understand this conversation. It's not sensible. I am not used to consulting children in my business.
Run along home, little britches. Your mama wants you.
Run home yourself, said I. Nobody asked you to come up here wearing your big spurs.
I told her she could go, said Rooster. I'll see after her.
No, said LaBeef. She'll be in the way.
Rooster said,
You're taking a lot on yourself.
LaBeef said,
She will spell nothing but trouble and confusion. You know that as well as I do. Stop and think. She has got you buffaloed with her saucy ways.
Rooster said,
Maybe I will just catch this Cheney myself and take all the money.
LaBeef considered it.
You might deliver him, he said.
I would see you did not collect anything for it.
How would you do that, Jaybird?
I'd dispute your claim. I would muddy the waters. They will not want much to back down. When it is all over, they might shake your hand and thank you for your trouble, and they might not.
If you did that, I would kill you, said Rooster. Where is your profit?
Where is yours? Said LaBeef. And I would not count too much on being able to shade somebody I didn't know.
I can shade you all right, said Rooster. I never seen anybody from Texas I couldn't shade. Get crossways of me, LaBeef, and you will think a thousand a brick has fell on you. You will wish you had been at the Alamo with Travis.
Knock him down, Rooster, said I.
LaBeef laughed. He said,
I believe she is trying to hoorah you again. Look here, I have had enough quarrel, and let us get on with our business. You have done your best to accommodate this little lady more than most people would do, and yet she will still be contrary. Send her on her way. We'll get her, man. That is what you agreed to do.
What if something happens to her?
Have you thought about that? Her people will blame you. And maybe the law will have something to say, too. Why don't you think about yourself? Do you think she's concerned with your interest? She's using you. You've got to be firm.
Rooster said,
I would hate to see anything happen to her.
You are thinking about that reward money, said I. It is a pig in a poke. All you have heard from LaBeef is talk, and I have paid you cash money. If you believe anything he says, I do not credit you with much sense. Look at him grin. He'll cheat you.
Rooster said,
I must think about myself some, too, sis.
I said,
Well, what are you going to do? You cannot carry water on both shoulders.
We'll get your man, said he. That's the main thing.
Let me have my $25. Hand it over.
I've spent it all.
You sorry piece of trash.
I'll try and get it back to you. I'll send it to you.
That's a big story. If you think you are going to cheat me like this, you are mistaken. You've not seen the last of Matty Ross, not by a good deal. I was so mad I could have bitten my tongue off. Sterling Price, the cat, sensed my mood, and he tucked his ears back and scampered from my path, giving me a wide berth. I suppose I must have cried a little, but it was a cold night, and by the time I reached the Monarch, my anger had cooled to the point where I could think straight and lay plans. There was not time enough to get another detective. Lawyer Daggett would be up here soon looking for me, probably no later than tomorrow. I thought about making a complaint to the head marshal. No, there was time for that later.
I would have Lawyer Daggett skin Rooster Cogburn and nail his verminous hide to the wall. The important thing was not to lose sight of my object, and that was to get Tom Chaney. I took supper and then set about getting my things together. I had Mrs. Floyd prepare some bacon and biscuits and make little sandwiches of them. But not so little as all that, as one of her biscuits would have made two of Mama's. Very flat, though, she skimped on baking powder. I also bought a small wedge of cheese from her and some dried peaches. These things I secured in a sack. Mrs. Floyd was alive with curiosity, and I told her I was going over into the territory with some marshals to look at a man they had arrested. This did not satisfy her by any means, but I pleaded ignorance of details. I told her I would likely be gone for several days, and if my mother or Lawyer Daggett made inquiries, a certainty, she was to reassure them as to my safety. I rolled up the blankets with the sack of food inside, and then wrapped the slicker around the roll and made it fast with some twine. I put Papa's heavy coat on, over my own coat. I had to turn the cuffs back. My little hat was not as thick and warm as his, so I traded. Of course, it was too big, and I had to fold up some pages from the New Era and stick them inside the band to make for a snug fit. I took my bundle and my gun sack and left for the stock barn. Stonehill was just leaving when I got there. He was singing the hymn Beulah Land to himself in a low bass voice. It is one of my favorites. He stopped singing when he saw me. "It is you again," said he. "Is there some complaint about the pony?" "No, I am very happy with him," said I. "Little Blackie is my chum." "A satisfied customer gladdens the heart." "I believe you have picked up some since last I saw you." "Yes, I am a little better. Richard's himself again, or will be ere the week is out. Are you leaving us?" "I am getting an early start tomorrow, and I thought I would stay the balance of the night in your barn. I don't see why I should pay Mrs. Floyd a full rate for only a few hours' sleep."
"Why, indeed?"
He took me inside the barn and told the watchman it would be all right for me to stay the night on the office bunk. The watchman was an old man. He helped me to shake out the dusty quilt that was on the bunk. I looked in on little Blackie at his stall and made sure everything was in readiness. The watchman followed me around. I said to him, "Are you the one that had his teeth knocked out?"
"No, that was Tim. Mine was drawn by a dentist. He called himself a dentist."
"Who are you?"
"Toby."
"I want you to do something."
"What are you up to?"
"I am not free to discuss it. Here is a dime for you. At 2 hours before sunup, I want you to feed this pony. Give him a double handful of oats and about the same amount of corn, but no more, along with a little hay. See that he has sufficient water. At 1 hour before sunup, I want you to wake me up. When you have done that, put this saddle and this bridle on the pony. Have you got it all straight?"
"I am not simple. I am just old. I've handled horses for 50 years.
"Then you should do a good job. Do you have any business in the office tonight?"
"I cannot think of any."
"If you do have, take care of it now."
"There's nothing I need in there."
"That's fine. I'll close the door, and I do not want a lot of coming and going while I'm trying to sleep." I slept well enough wrapped in the quilt. The fire in the office stove had been banked, but the little room was not so cold as to be very uncomfortable. The watchman Toby was true to his word, and he woke me up in the chill darkness before dawn. I was up and buttoning my boots in a moment. While Toby saddled the horse, I washed myself, using some of his hot coffee water to take the sting out of a bucket of cold water. It came to me that I should have left one of the bacon sandwiches out of the bundle for breakfast, but you can never think of everything. I did not want to open it up now. Toby gave me a portion of his grits that he had warmed up.
"Do you not have any butter to put on it?" I asked him.
"No," said he, and I had to eat it plain.
I tied my roll behind the saddle, as I had seen Papa do, and I made doubly sure it was secure. I could see no good place to carry the pistol. I wanted the piece ready at hand, but the belt was too big around for my waist, and the pistol itself was far too big and heavy to stick in the waist of my jeans. I finally tied the neck of the gun sack to the saddle horn with a good knot about the size of a turkey egg. I led little Blackie from his stall and mounted him. He was a little nervous and jumpy, but he did not pitch. Toby tightened the girth again after I was aboard. He said,
"Have you got everything?"
"Yes, I believe I am ready. Open the door, Toby, and wish me luck. I am off for the Choctaw Nation." It was still dark outside and bitter cold, although mercifully there was little wind. Why is it calm in the early morning? You will notice that lakes are usually still and smooth before daybreak. The frozen, rutted mud of the streets made uncertain going for little Blackie in his new shoes. He snorted and snapped his head from time to time, as though to look at me. I talked to him, saying silly things. Only 4 or 5 people were to be seen as I rode down Garrison Avenue, and they scurrying from one warm place to another. I could see lamps coming on through windows as the good people of Fort Smith began to stir for the new day. When I reached the ferry slip on the river, I dismounted and waited. I had to move and dance about to keep from getting stiff. I removed the paper wadding from inside the hat band and pulled the hat down over my ears. I had no gloves, and I rolled Papa's coat sleeves down so that my hands might be covered. There were 2 men running the ferry. When it reached my side and discharged a horseman, one of the ferrymen hailed me.
"Are you going across?" said he.
"I'm waiting for someone," said I. "What is the fare?"
10 cents for a horse and rider."
"Have you seen Marshal Cogburn this morning?"
"Is that Rooster Cogburn?"
"That is the man."
"We've not seen him."
There were few passengers at that hour, but as soon as 1 or 2 turned up, the ferry would depart. It seemed to have no schedule, except as business demanded, but then the crossing was not a long one. As gray dawn came, I could make out chunks of ice bobbing along, out in the current of the river. The boat made at least 2 circuits before Rooster and LaBeef appeared and came riding down the incline to the slip. I had begun to worry that I might have missed them. Rooster was mounted on a big bay stallion that stood at about 16 hands, and LaBeef on a shaggy cowpony not much bigger than mine. Well, they were a sight to see with all their arms. They were both wearing their belt guns around their outside coats, and LaBeef cut a splendid figure with his white-handled pistols and Mexican spurs. Rooster was wearing a deerskin jacket over his black suit coat. He carried only 1 revolver on his belt, an ordinary-looking piece with grips of cedar or some reddish wood. On the other side, the right side, he wore a dirk knife. His gun belt was not fancy like LaBeef's, but only a plain and narrow belt with no cartridge loops. He carried his cartridges in a sack in his pocket. But he also had 2 more revolvers in saddle scabbards at his thighs. They were big pistols, like mine. The 2 officers also packed saddle guns, Rooster a Winchester repeating rifle, and LaBeef a gun called a Sharps rifle, a kind I had never seen. My thought was this: Cheney, look out. They dismounted and led their horses aboard the ferry in a clatter, and I followed at a short distance. I said nothing. I was not trying to hide, but neither did I do anything to call attention to myself. It was a minute or so before Rooster recognized me.
"Sure enough, we've got company," said he.
LaBeef was very angry.
"Can you not get anything through your head?"
he said to me. "Get off this boat. Did you suppose you were going with us?" I replied, "This ferry is open to the public. I've paid my fare."
Labeef reached in his pocket and brought out a gold dollar. He handed it to one of the ferrymen and said,
"Slam, take this girl to town and present her to the sheriff. She is a runaway. Her people are worried nearly to death about her. There's a $50 reward for her return."
"That is a story," said I.
"Let us ask the marshal," said Labeef.
"What about it, marshal?"
Rooster said,
"Yes, you'd best take her away. She is a runaway, all right. Her name is Ross, and she came up from Yale County. The sheriff has a notice on her."
"They are in this story together," said I. "I have business across the river, and if you interfere with me, Slim, you may find yourself in court where you don't want to be. I have a good lawyer."
But the tall river rat would pay no heed to my protests. He led my pony back onto the slip, and the boat pulled away without me. I said,
"I'm not going to walk up the hill."
I mounted Little Blackie, and the river rat led us up the hill. When we reached the top, I said,
"Wait, stop a minute."
He said, "What is it?"
I said, "There's something wrong with my hat."
He stopped and turned around.
"Your hat," said he.
I took it off and slapped him in the face with it 2 or 3 times and made him drop the reins. I recovered them and wheeled Little Blackie about and rode him down the bank for all he was worth. I had no spurs or switch, but I used my hat on his flank to good effect. About 50 yards below the ferry slip, the river narrowed, and I aimed for the place, going like blazes across a sandbar. I popped Blackie all the way with my hat, as I was afraid he might shy at the water, and I did not want to give him a chance to think about it. We hit the river running, and Blackie snorted and arched his back against the icy water, but once he was in, he swam as though he was raised to it. I drew up my legs behind me and held to the saddle horn and gave Blackie his head with loose reins. I was considerably splashed. The crossing was badly chosen, because the narrow place of a river is the deepest, and it is there that the current is swiftest and the bank steepest, but these things did not occur to me at the time. Shortest looked best. We came out some little ways down the river, and, as I say, the bank was steep, and Blackie had some trouble climbing it. When we were up and free, I reined in, and Little Blackie gave himself a good shaking. Rooster and Labeef and the ferryman were looking at us from the boat. We had beaten them across. I stayed where I was. When they got off the boat, Labeef hailed me, saying,
"Go back, I say."
I made no reply. He and Rooster had a parley. Their game soon became clear. They mounted quickly and rode off at a gallop with the idea of leaving me. What a foolish plan, pitting horses so heavily loaded with men and hardware against a pony so lightly burdened as Blackie. Our course was northwesterly on the Fort Gibson Road, if you could call it a road. This was the Cherokee Nation. Little Blackie had a hard gait, a painful trot, and I made him speed up and slow down until he had achieved a pace, a kind of lope, that was not so jarring. He was a fine, spirited pony. He enjoyed this outing, you could tell. We rode that way for 2 miles or more, Blackie and I hanging back from the officers at about 100 yards. Rooster and Labeef at last saw they were making no gain, and they slowed their horses to a walk. I did the same. After a mile or so of this, they stopped and dismounted. I stopped too, keeping my distance, and remained in the saddle. Labeef shouted,
"Come here. We'll have a conversation with you."
"You can talk from there," I replied. "What is it you have to say?"
The two officers had another parley. Then Labeef shouted to me again, saying,
"If you do not go back now, I am going to whip you."
I made no reply.
Labeef picked up a rock and threw it in my direction. It fell short by about 50 yards. I said. That is the most foolish thing that ever I saw.
LaBeef said,
Is that what you will have, a whipping?
I said,
You are not going to whip anybody.
They talked some more between themselves, but could not seem to settle on anything. And, after a time, they rode off again, this time at a comfortable lope. Few travelers were on the road, only an Indian now and then on a horse or a mule, or a family in a spring wagon. I will own I was somewhat afraid of them, although they were not, as you may imagine, wild Comanches with painted faces and outlandish garb, but rather civilized Creeks and Cherokees and Choctaws from Mississippi and Alabama, who had owned slaves and fought for the Confederacy and wore store clothes. Neither were they sullen and grave. I thought them on the cheerful side as they nodded and spoke greetings. From time to time, I would lose sight of Rooster and LaBeef as they went over a rise or around a bend of trees, but only briefly. I had no fears that they could escape me. Now, I will say something about the land. Some people think the present state of Oklahoma is all treeless plains. They are wrong. The eastern part, where we were traveling, is hilly and fairly well timbered, with post oak and blackjack and similar hard scrub. A little farther south, there is a good deal of pine as well. But right along in here at this time of year, the only touches of green to be seen were cedar brakes and solitary holly trees, and a few big cypresses down in the bottoms. Still, there were open places, little meadows and prairies, and from the tops of those low hills, you could usually see a good long distance. Then this happened. I was riding along wool gathering instead of keeping alert, and as I came over a rise, I discovered the road below me deserted. I nudged the willing Blackie with my heels. The two officers could not be far ahead. I knew they were up to some stunt. At the bottom of the hill, there was a stand of trees and a shallow creek. I was not looking for them there at all. I thought they had raced on ahead. Just as Blackie was splashing across the creek, Rooster and LaBeef sprang from the brush on their horses. They were right in my path. Little Blackie reared, and I was almost thrown. LaBeef was off his horse before you could say Jack Robinson, and at my side. He pulled me from the saddle and threw me to the ground, face down. He twisted one of my arms behind me and put his knee in my back. I kicked and struggled, but the big Texan was too much for me. "Now we will see what tune you sang," said he. He snapped a limb off a willow bush and commenced to push one of my trouser legs above my boot. I kicked violently so that he could not manage the trouser leg. Rooster remained on his horse. He sat up there in the saddle and rolled a cigarette and watched. The more I kicked, the harder LaBeef pressed down with his knee, and I soon saw the game was up. I left off struggling. LaBeef gave me a couple of sharp licks with the switch. He said, "I am going to stripe your leg good." "See what good it does you," said I. I began to cry. I could not help it, but more from anger and embarrassment than pain. I said to Rooster, "Are you going to let him do this?" He dropped his cigarette to the ground and said, "No, I don't believe I will. Put your switch away, LaBeef. She has got the best of us."
"She has not got the best of me," replied the ranger.
Rooster said, "That will do," I said. LaBeef paid him no heed. Rooster raised his voice and said, "Put that switch down, LaBeef. Do you hear me talking to you?" LaBeef stopped and looked at him. Then he said, "I am going ahead with what I started." Rooster pulled his cedar-handled revolver and cocked it with his thumb and threw down on LaBeef. He said, "It will be the biggest mistake you ever made, you Texas brush popper." LaBeef flung the switch away in disgust and stood up. He said,
"You have taken her part in this all along, Cogburn. Well, you're not doing her any kindness here. Do you think you are doing the right thing? I can tell you, you are doing the wrong thing."
Rooster said,
"That will do. Get on your horse."
I brushed the dirt from my clothes and washed my hands and face in the cold creek water. Little Blackie was getting himself a drink from the stream. I said, "Listen here, I have thought of something. This stunt that you two pulled has given me an idea. When we locate Chaney, a good plan will be for us to jump him from the brush and hit him on the head with sticks and knock him insensible. Then we can bind his hands and feet with rope and take him back alive. What do you think? But Rooster was angry, and he only said,
"Get on your horse."
We resumed our journey in thoughtful silence, the three of us now riding together and pushing deeper into the territory to I knew not what. Dinner time came and went, and on we rode. I was hungry and aching, but I kept my peace, for I knew the both of them were waiting for me to complain or say something that would make me out a tenderfoot. I was determined not to give them anything to chaff me about. Some large wet flakes of snow began to fall, then changed to soft drizzling rain, then stopped altogether, and the sun came out. We turned left off the Fort Gibson Road and headed south, back down toward the Arkansas River. I say down. South is not down any more than north is up. I've seen maps carried by immigrants going to California that showed west at the top and east at the bottom. Our stopping place was a store on the riverbank. Behind it, there was a small ferry boat. We dismounted and tied up our horses. My legs were tingling and weak, and I tottered a little as I walked. Nothing can take the starch out of you like a long ride on horseback. A black mule was tied up to the porch of the store. He had a cotton rope around his neck, right up under his jaw. The sun had caused the wet rope to draw up tight, and the mule was gasping and choking for breath. The more he tugged, the worse he made it. Two wicked boys were sitting on the edge of the porch, laughing at the mule's discomfort. One was white, and the other was an Indian. They were about 17 years of age. Rooster cut the rope with his dirk knife, and the mule breathed easy again. The grateful beast wandered off, shaking his head about. A cypress stump served for a step up to the porch. Rooster went up first and walked over to the two boys and kicked them off into the mud with the flat of his boot.
"Call that sport, do you?" said he.
They were two mighty surprised boys. The storekeeper was a man named Bagby with an Indian wife. They had already had dinner, but the woman warmed up some catfish for us that she had left over. LaBeef and I sat at a table near the stove and ate, while Rooster had a conference with the man Bagby at the back of the store. The Indian woman spoke good English, and I learned to my surprise that she too was a Presbyterian. She had been schooled by a missionary. What preachers we had in those days! Truly, they took the word and took the highways and hedges. Mrs. Bagby was not a Cumberland Presbyterian, but a member of the U.S. or Southern Presbyterian Church. I, too, am now a member of the Southern Church. I say nothing against the Cumberlands. They broke with the Presbyterian Church because they did not believe a preacher needed a lot of formal education. That is all right, but they are not sound on election. They do not fully accept it. I confess it is a hard doctrine, running contrary to our earthly ideas of fair play, but I can see no way around it. Read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 13, and 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Also, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 2, 19, and 20, and Romans chapter 11, verse 7. There you have it. It was good for Paul and Silas, and it is good enough for me. It is good enough for you, too. Rooster finished his parley and joined us in our fish dinner. Mrs. Bagby wrapped up some gingerbread for me to take along. When we went back out on the porch, Rooster kicked the two boys into the mud again. He said,
"Where's Virgil?"
The white boy said, "He and Mr. Simmons is off down in the bottoms looking for strays."
"Who is running the ferry?"
"Me and Johnny."
"You don't look like you have sense enough to run a boat. Either one of you."
"We know how to run it."
"Then let us get to it."
"Mr. Simmons will want to know who cut his mule loose," said the boy.
"Tell him it was Mr. James, a bank examiner of Clay County, Missouri," said Rooster. "Can you remember the name?"
"Yes, sir."
We led our horses down to the water's edge. The boat or raft was a rickety, waterlogged affair, and the horses nickered and balked when we tried to make them go aboard. I did not much blame them. Labeef had to blindfold his shaggy pony. There just was room for all of us. Before casting off, the white boy said,
"You said James?"
"That is the name," said Rooster.
"The James boys are said to be slight men."
"One of them has grown fat," said Rooster.
"I don't believe you are Jesse or Frank James, either one."
"The mule will not range far," said Rooster. "See that you mend your ways, boy, or I will come back some dark night and cut off your head and let the crows peck your eyeballs out. Now, you and Admiral Sims, get us across this river and be damn quick about it."
A ghostly fog lay on top of the water, and it enveloped us, about to the waist of a man, as we pushed off. Mean and backward though they were, the two boys handled the boat with considerable art. They pulled and guided us along on a heavy rope that was tied fast to trees on either bank. We swung across in a looping downstream curve, with the current doing most of the work. We got our feet wet, and I was happy to get off the thing. The road we picked up on the south bank was little more than a pig trail. The brush arched over and closed in on us at the top, and we were slapped and stung with limbs. I was riding last, and I believe I got the worst of it. Here is what Rooster learned from the man Bagby. Lucky Ned Pepper had been seen 3 days earlier at McAllister's store on the MK&T railroad tracks. His intentions were not known. He went there from time to time to pay attention to a lewd woman. A robber called Hayes and a Mexican had been seen in his company. And that was all the man knew. Rooster said we would be better off if we could catch the robber band before they left the neighborhood of McAllister's and return to their hiding place in the fastness of the Winding Stair Mountains. Labeef said, "How far is it to McAllister's?"
"A good 60 miles, said Rooster. "We'll make another 15 miles today and get an early start tomorrow."
I groaned and made a face at the thought of riding another 15 miles that day, and Rooster turned and caught me.
"How do you like this coon hunt?" said he.
"Do not be looking around for me," said I. "I'll be right here." Labeef said, "But Chelmsford was not with him?"
Rooster said, "He was not seen at McAllister's with him. It is certain he was with him on the mail hack job. He will be around somewhere near, or I miss my guess. The way Ned cuts his winnings, I know the boy did not realize enough on that job to travel far."
We made a camp that night on the crest of a hill, where the ground was not so soggy. It was a very dark night. The clouds were low and heavy, and neither the moon or stars could be seen. Rooster gave me a canvas bucket and sent me down the hill about 200 yards for water. I carried my gun along. I had no lantern, and I stumbled and fell with the first bucket before I got far and had to retrace my steps and get another. Labeef unsaddled the horses and fed them from nose bags. On the second trip, I had to stop and rest about 3 times coming up the hill. I was stiff and tired and sore. I had the gun in one hand, but it was not enough to balance the weight of the heavy bucket, which pulled me sideways as I walked. Rooster was squatting down building a fire, and he watched me. He said,
"You look like a hog on ice."
I said, "I am not going down there again. If you want any more water, you will have to fetch it yourself."
"Everyone in my party must do his job."
"Anyhow, it tastes like iron." Labeef was rubbing down his shaggy pony. He said,
"You're lucky to be traveling in a place where a spring is so handy. In my country, you can ride for days and see no groundwater. I have lapped filthy water from a hoof print and was glad to have it. You don't know what discomfort is until you have nearly perished for water."
Rooster said,
"If I ever meet one of you Texas waddies that says he never drank from a horse track, I think I will shake his hand and give him a Daniel Webster cigar."
"Then you don't believe it?" asked Labeef.
"I believed it the first 25 times I heard it."
"Maybe he did drink from one," said I. "He is a Texas Ranger.
Is that what he is? Said Rooster. Well, now, I can believe that.
LaBeef said,
You're getting ready to show your ignorance now, Cogburn. I don't mind a little personal chaffing, but I won't hear anything against the Ranger Troop from a man like you.
The Ranger Troop, said Rooster, with some contempt.
I tell you what you do. You go tell John Wesley Hardin about the Ranger Troop. Don't tell me and Sis.
Anyhow, we know what we are about. That is more than I can say for you political marshals.
Rooster said,
How long have you boys been mounted on sheep down there?
LaBeef stopped rubbing his shaggy pony. He said,
This horse will be galloping when that big American stud of yours is winded and collapsed. You cannot judge by looks. The most villainous-looking pony is often your gamest performer. What would you guess this pony cost me?
Rooster said,
If there is anything in what you say, I would guess about $1,000.
You will have your joke, but he cost me $110, said LaBeef. I would not sell him for that. It is hard to get in the Rangers if you do not own a $100 horse.
Rooster set about preparing our supper. Here is what he brought along for grub, a sack of salt and a sack of red pepper and a sack of taffy, all this in his jacket pockets, and then some ground coffee beans and a big slab of salt pork and 170 corn dodgers. I could scarcely credit it. The corn dodgers were balls of what I would call hot water cornbread. Rooster said the woman who prepared them thought the order was for a wagon party of marshals.
Well, said he, when they get too hard to eat plain, we can make mush from them, and what we have left we can give to the stock.
He made some coffee in a can and fried some pork. Then he sliced up some of the dodgers and fried the pieces in grease. Fried bread, that was a new dish to me. He and LaBeef made fast work of about a pound of pork and a dozen dodgers. I ate some of my bacon sandwiches and a piece of gingerbread and drank the rusty-tasting water. We had a blazing fire, and the wet wood crackled fiercely and sent off showers of sparks. It was cheerful and heartening against the gloomy night. LaBeef said that he was not accustomed to such a big fire, that in Texas they frequently had little more than a fire of twigs or buffalo chips with which to warm up their beans. He asked Rooster if it was wise to make our presence known in unsettled country with a big fire. He said it was ranger policy not to sleep in the same place as where they had cooked their supper. Rooster said nothing and threw more limbs on the fire. I said, Would you two like to hear the story of the Midnight Caller? One of you will have to be the caller. I will tell you what to say. I will do all the other parts myself. But they were not interested in hearing ghost stories, and I put my slicker on the ground as close to the fire as I dared and proceeded to make my bed with the blanket. My feet were so swollen from the ride that my boots were hard to pull off. Rooster and LaBeef drank some whiskey, but it did not make them sociable, and they sat there without talking. Soon they got out their bedrolls. Rooster had a nice buffalo robe for a ground sheet. It looked warm and comfortable, and I envied him for it. He took a horsehair lariat from his saddle and arranged it in a loop around his bed. LaBeef watched him and grinned. He said, That is a piece of foolishness. All the snakes are asleep this time of year.
They have been known to wake up, said Rooster.
I said, Let me have a rope, too. I am not fond of snakes.
A snake would not bother with you, said Rooster. You are too little and bony.
He put an oak log in the fire and banked coals and ashes against it and turned in for the night. Both the officers snored, and one of them made a wet mouth noise along with it. It was disgusting. Exhausted as I was, I had trouble falling asleep. I was warm enough, but there were roots and rocks under me, and I moved this way and that, trying to improve my situation. I was sore, and the movement was painful. I finally despaired of ever getting fixed right. I said my prayers, but did not mention my discomfort. This trip was my own doing.
When I awoke, there were snowflakes on my eyes. Big, moist flakes were sifting down through the trees. There was a light covering of white on the ground. It was not quite daylight, but Rooster was already up, boiling coffee and frying meat. LaBeef was attending to the horses, and he had them saddled. I wanted some hot food, so I passed up the biscuits and ate some of the salt meat and fried bread. I shared my cheese with the officers.
My hands and face smelled of smoke. Rooster hurried us along in breaking camp. He was concerned about the snow.
"If this keeps up, we'll want shelter tonight," he said.
LeBeef had already fed the stock, but I took one of the corn dodgers and gave it to Little Blackie to see if he would eat it. He relished it, and I gave him another. Rooster said horses particularly liked the salt that was in them. He directed me to wear my slicker. Sunrise was only a pale yellow glow through the overcast, but such as it was, it found us mounted and moving once again. The snow came thicker, and the flakes grew bigger as goose feathers, and they were not falling down like rain, but rather flying dead level into our faces. In the space of 4 hours, it collected on the ground to a depth of 6 or 7 inches. Out in the open places, the trail was hard to follow, and we stopped often so that Rooster could get his bearings. This was a hard job, because the ground told him nothing and he could not see distant landmarks. Indeed, at times, we could see only a few feet in any direction. His spyglass was useless. We came across no people and no houses. Our progress was very slow. There was no great question of getting lost, because Rooster had a compass, and as long as we kept a southwesterly course, we would sooner or later strike the Texas Road and the MK&T Railroad tracks. But it was inconvenient not being able to keep the regular trail, and with the snow, the horses ran the danger of stepping into holes. Along about noon, we stopped at a stream on the lee side of a mountain to water the horses. There we found some small relief from the wind and snow. I believe these were the San Boys Mountains. I passed the balance of my cheese around, and Rooster shared his candy. With that, we made our dinner. While we were stretching our legs at that place, we heard some flapping noises down the stream, and LeBeef went into the woods to investigate. He found a flock of turkeys roosting in a tree, and shot one of them with his Sharp's rifle. The bird was considerably ripped up. It was a hen, weighing about 7 pounds. LeBeef gutted it and cut its head off and tied it to his saddle. Rooster allowed that we could not now reach McAllister's store before dark, and that our best course was to bear west for a dugout that some squatter had built not far from the Texas Road. No one occupied the place, he said, and we could find shelter there for the night. Tomorrow we could make our way south on the Texas Road, which was broad and packed clear and hard from cattle herds and freighter wagons. There would be little risk of crippling a horse on that highway. After our rest, we departed in single file, with Rooster's big horse breaking the trail. Little Blackie had no need for my guidance, and I looped the ends of the reins around the saddle horn and withdrew my cold hands into the sleeves of my many coats. We surprised a herd of deer feeding off the bark of saplings, and LeBeef went for his rifle again, but they had flown before he could get it unlimbered. By and by the snow let up, and yet our progress was still limited to a walk. It was good dark when we came to the dugout. We had a little light from a moon that was in and out of the clouds. The dugout stood at the narrow end of a V-shaped hollow or valley. I had never before seen such a dwelling. It was small, only about 10 feet by 20 feet, and half of it was sunk back into a clay bank, like a cave. The part that was sticking out was made of poles and sod, and the roof was also of sod, supported by a ridge pole in the center. A brush arbor shed and cave adjoined it for livestock. There was a sufficiency of timber here for a log cabin, although mostly hardwood. I suppose, too, that the man who built the thing was in a hurry and wanted for proper tools. A cockeyed chimney of sticks and mud stuck up through the bank at the rear of the house. It put me in mind of something made by a water bird, some cliff martin or a swift, although the work of those little feathered masons, who know not the use of a spirit level, is a sight more artful. We were surprised to see smoke and sparks coming from the chimney. Light showed through the cracks around the door, which was a low, crude thing hung to the sill by leather hinges. There was no window. We had halted in a cedar break. Rooster dismounted and told us to wait. He took his Winchester repeating rifle and approached the door. He made a lot of noise as his boots broke through the crust that had now formed on top of the snow. When he was about 20 feet from the dugout, the door opened just a few inches. A man's face appeared in the light, and a hand came out holding a revolver. Rooster stopped. The face said,
"Who is it out there?"